Tisdalot wanted to make sure to include that story. Bill Gallo joining us here next, and we'll go from there. I don't want to launch into too much more before Bill joins us. And I will reiterate, and I'm sure we'll get Aaron Crady probably tomorrow. Tomorrow at this hour, Wednesday to Friday. Reminder, TCA, Thoroughbred Charities, 31st Stallion Season Auction. And it is a, you know, a comprehensive list of, you know, obviously the, you know, the Kentucky lineup, but Arizona, by the way, opening day at Turf Paradise yesterday, Arizona, California, Florida, Indiana, I mean, virtually every, you know, New York, Justin Phillip in New Mexico, Louisiana, Maryland, Ohio, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, Texas, West Virginia. So all the regional breeding programs represented in the Stallion Season Auction. Starts tomorrow, 9 a.m., and goes to Friday, 4:30. And it's the, you know, it's the major fundraiser, as we said with Aaron late last year. There's also, if you go to the website, there's also the memorabilia. So if you're not, you know, if you're not a in the market for Stallion Season, TCA.org, okay? And right on the front page, 31st Annual Stallion Season and online. And then there's the silent auction. Goes a little bit longer. Silent auction goes from Wednesday till next Tuesday. And there's all kinds of halters, and there's goods and services and so forth. Bill Gallo standing by. And, of course, yesterday the news circulated. We had just started the show. And one of the news and notes that I had from the 2 weeks away was the race at Limerick, Baltimore Bucko, the Shepherd String in Ireland. And that's where the horses under Jonathan's name will compete going forward. His 50-plus year career in North America coming to a close. Bill Gallo, good morning. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Steve. Good to talk to you.
Bill, there had been some rumors and rumblings about this, and Jonathan's career is... It's difficult to quantify. I mean, the champions and the success of, you know, on the flat and over the jumps.
Yeah, it's a remarkable career. You know, I've known him for a long time, since 1977, 40 some odd years. I watched his career just skyrocket to such a dominant place, and he literally ruled the roost for years and years, and until the last decade or so, when, you know, Jack Fisher kind of leapfrogged him there. But it's pretty remarkable that, you know, Jonathan came back and won the title last year, even though it was an abbreviated year. But it was great for him, great for his stable. He didn't have a presence throughout the year. He left everything in the hands of his assistant, Kerry Breon. He was on the phone every day. I'm training on the phone from Florida. Just a remarkable career. It's almost inexplicable, mind-boggling. Jack Fisher's got a big mountain to climb. Not that he couldn't achieve what Shepherd did, but it's going to be it'll take him a while, that's for sure. But a wonderful trainer, a wonderful guy, very bright guy. Incredible at his craft, and incredibly important to not only the National Steeplechase Association, but just steeplechasing in general. What he did for us, he kind of really, he's the most recognizable name, most recognizable figure in our game, certainly throughout my career, the last 40-some-odd years. But great man. I'm sure you'll get some great tributes about him today with the variety of people you're going to have on. But I'm just pleased to know him, and I learned a lot from him. Worked. He was actually the president of an SA for a while, for 3 years period, and towards the latter part of his career. And so I worked closely there. I worked with him as a pretty good working relationship over the years. Wasn't always the friendliest as a handicapper. He had obviously the best horses, and some of those horses got pretty high up ladder, you know, reached incredible levels in the handicap division. So there were times we had a kind of a contentious relationship about handicap weights and things like that. But it was a great run for him. I believe he's just read he was 80 years old. He never seemed very old to me. He just he was always sharp, incredibly mentally sharp. And he's, you know, one of the things that always sticks out in my mind, he was everywhere. He just showed up at the most remote places. It was an extraordinary commitment that he had to not only his own stable but to the sport itself. He really loved to support the smaller race meets, some of the smaller race meets on our circuit. You know, he could fill a card, literally. It sent six or seven or eight horses down to a small place in Tryon, North Carolina, and back in the days, sweep the card as well. But still, his presence and his name is extremely meaningful to the National Steeplechase Association.
How valuable? Kind of a two-part question. How valuable was it to have Shepherd, who, you know, for an extended period was able to, you know, straddle the flat portion, you know, with the steeplechase horses and campaigning? And had there really been anybody previously that you know, was, I guess, simultaneously Tom Voss to an extent? But I mean, how many historically, how many crossover horsemen, you know, had this level of success?
No one prior to Shepherd. Not that kind of success.
Interesting.
The guy trained Breeders' Cup champions. He eclipsed champions on the flat. But it's a very important part because, you know, that's what you and I have had this discussion many times. But, you know, there's a common misconception that the steeplechase horse is not even a thoroughbred. Some people within the industry don't even realize that our horses are thoroughbreds that jump fences. And Shepherd clearly bridged that gap. I mean, he proved that, a trainer can accomplish great things both on the flat and over jumps. And even though he started out in the jump game, he segued across and kept going back and forth. So, the level of expertise and the level of achievement is unbelievable when you think of it that way. Tom Voss is the only other name I can think of that kind of crossed over a little bit and did both successfully, but you just said it. They were doing it at the same time. But, you know, Voss's career was wonderful, but it pales in comparison to Shepherd.
His, you know, it's funny, until I read John Clippinger's piece, I really didn't know his origin story in terms of coming over and why it was that his career couldn't start in the UK.
Yeah, ironically, his father was a handicapper, and it was a conflict of interest, and that prohibited him from taking out a license, and that's why he first came over in the mid-60s. But that's it's an interesting development because it basically put him in a whole different direction. I think he was in finance at first. I mean, he's well educated. He went to Eton, I believe. He's a very well educated man, and had aspirations of the business world, but that didn't suit him. He had a love and appreciation of the horse, and one thing led to another, but it was his father's position in England that forced him to come to America to launch a career in training.
You worked for Burling Cox.
He did work for Burley Cox. Burley Cox trained a lot of people, like Billy Turner and people like that. And so, but he did work for Burley, learned a lot from Burley, obviously, and you know, went on his, out on his own at a, you know, relatively young age. I mean, 50-some-odd years. It's incredible. It really is. I can't think of anybody in any other sport that you can sort of measure up to. His consecutive streak of winning races, you've talked about it many times on the show, winning...
Sure.
Consecutively in Saratoga for that period of time, I think it was 47 years or something like that.
47 years with a win.
A win in Saratoga. I mean, that's, no one will ever do that again.
No.
So there's a lot of things Shepard's done that, you know, people will not be able to get done. But I think the streak in Saratoga is one of the most remarkable streaks and anything, including baseball, Joe DiMaggio.
the individual horses. I mean, you know, we've certainly, you know, talked about, you know, the horses like Flatterer and you know, the any number of the jump champions. I mentioned, you know, the conversations that we had during the run of Forever Together and Informed Decision. But, you know, there's other aspects too. The little sidebar about Stormcat and,
yeah,
and he, when Stormcat died, Jonathan, we had a, you know, very big show that, when Stormcat passed away, and, his, you know, his involvement, not just training Stormcat, but then, and this is in Clippinger's piece too, the fact that that his wife urged Mr. Young to, you know, to keep him at Overbrook, and because
right,
they were ready to try to, you know, sell him or syndicate him somewhere, and it ended up being a fateful decision and a very important decision.
No, absolutely. Yeah, no, I remember vividly the Stormcat days. I mean, he trained him as a two-year-old. And, it was, you're right, I read that yesterday, Don Clippinger's piece about Kathy Shepard encouraging Mr. Young to keep him there. And obviously his stud career, it was remarkable, to say the least. But for sure, Shepard had a share in the horse. So, it certainly paid a few bills, that's for sure, over the years.
Now, the number of and the names, you know, for those virtually anybody, I suppose, has got, whatever era you were introduced to the game, there's a Shepherd horse for you. you know, going back, like you said, to the 70s. And you know, then you look at, I'm looking at some, you know, some of the names, some you forget about, Nine Pins and Mixed Up. And
he had a bunch of great horses. A story just came to my mind. I got a call one day. This is back in the, right around 1990, early 90s. But I got a call from Mr. Hubbard, R.D. Hubbard, California. And I didn't really know Mr. Hubbard. I knew of him, obviously. But I got this impromptu call from Mr. Hubbard. And he said, this is Steeplechase office. And yeah. And he said, I got a horse. I got a turf horse. And I somebody told me I should jump them. I don't know anything about this Steeplechase thing. So can you, if I was to go to a trainer, you know, what is, you know, there's only one name I know. He said, this guy Shepherd. And this is this conversation actually happened. I was sitting in my office in Maryland, where I'm sitting right now, in fact. And I said, well, Mr. Hubbard, yeah, you've touched upon the key name there, but if you have a turf horse that wants to go long and you're interested in steeplechasing, Jonathan Chase, can you give me that guy's number? And I did, and the horse was a Chilean bred called Mystico. It was a multiple stakes winner over jumps, a very nice horse. We had run out of flat conditions, and sure enough, obviously, he called Shepherd, and Shepherd got the horse and turned him into a stakes horse, but, you know, once again, it's a small illustration of how powerful the guy's name was, and what a presence he had in the game. He's the only person that Mr. Hubbard even knew in steeplechasing. But I always remember that story. I hadn't thought of that story for a long time until we just had this conversation.
That's a great story. I'm sure. Yeah, these conversations. We'll see what Graham. You know, Graham was around for Flatterer, and I'm anxious to hear from the training side and the kinds of things that that Graham picked up from Shepard. You think about when you look at any of the horses and some of the riders that are tied to and some of the most successful opportunities that they had in their careers. And I think of Danielle Hodson, certainly, and I'm sure if you went through the litany and you'd pick out certain eras, and the jump jocks have windows of opportunity until they either get either too big or they fall one too many times and say that's enough. Blythe Miller, right? Blythe Miller rode plenty.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Blythe rode for him. I mean, Blythe rode for a car. Rode Lonesome Glory, which is the most famous. But yeah, she definitely rode for Shepard and Danielle Hodson. You're right. I mean, there were several jockeys that came through his stable. John Cushman was champion. Jerry Fishback, of course, rode for him. So it's he was good with the jockeys. He was he trained other trainers. Janet Elliott, Hall of Famer Janet Elliott, came up in the Shepherd stable. And of course, Graham Motion. Make sure you ask Graham Motion about Flatter and the weight he carried, because those were some of the contentious times. Horse carried 176 pounds and won with 176 pounds. I think.
Yep.
I put the weights. That was back in the mid 80s. I mean, he was a 4-time Eclipse champion. 4 years in a row, and I can't remember what year that was. It was probably year 3 or maybe even 4, but he carried 176 pounds and won the race, and then was entered back a couple of weeks later, and we had to bump in another handicap, and we bumped into 78. He didn't run with the 78. Shepard ended up scratching him, but it was, oh, God, I was horrified watching the race when he won. Carrying 176. Jerry Fishback rode him, and when he hit, it was a place called Radnor in Pennsylvania, and when he hit the wire, Fishback, not too many strides past the wire, Fishback jumped off the horse, literally, which was, he pulled him up immediately and jumped off him to get the weight off him, which I thought was pretty interesting. But anyway, Shepard, he had some great jumpers. Flatter, of course, is in the Hall of Fame. Cafe Prince is in the Hall of Fame. I think those are his two jumpers in the Hall of Fame. And then, you go on and on. You could write, Clippinger wrote a long piece about him. You could write a book about him for sure.
Yeah, and I, as I'm looking at this, at these other non-jump winners, here's one that, if we reached out to Rosemary Holmeister Jr., she would certainly appreciate. She ended up on Cloudy's Night when Jonathan got him from Frank Kirby. And he had that really good year and a half or so, including those wins at, I can't remember if he won 2 in a row at Kentucky Downs, but he had a really nice sequence of mile and a half turf tries that Rosemary was tied on, and it was a very cool success story that kind of came out of left field.
Yeah, and he was Shepard. He gave a lot of people an opportunities, much like Alan Jerkins. He was a champion for the little guy and always wanted to help either the young rider or the. Yesterday, I read he said it's a he liked about the national steeplechasers were really a sport. It's much more of a sport than flat racing. But, which that was, I think that's his interpretation, because he liked the social part of it. Not that he was a real social kind of guy, but he, The steeplechase community is a tight-knit community, and you go to the races, and it's more relaxed than going to a racetrack, things like that. So I think that appealed to him over the years for sure, and that's just why he was itinerant. He was everywhere. He just showed up. The most remote place, he showed up, and he drove. He drove, I don't know how many thousands of miles he drove, but he drove everywhere constantly. Put a lot of miles on the car, probably broke a lot of cars down, but what a trainer. And it's this is a celebration. It's a happy thing because he certainly deserves it. I love the fact that he won the championship last year, and he goes out on such a high note. If I think about what he's done with Kerry Breon, who's, going to probably launch her own training career now. Certainly, I think she worked for him. I think she's worked for him about a decade, 10 years or so, and she did a remarkable job in his physical absence last year.
Well, the career, and you talk about the dedication and how driven, obviously, he was. I mean, and warm and cuddly, he's not, and he wasn't ever. And from that standpoint, he was. You don't amass a career like this without some. I think it's fair to say, Bill, that it comes in some cases at the cost of some personal, the personal life expense. I mean, he was, really driven. You think about people like Lucas and Van Berg, you don't have this kind of success, without being consumed by, by the work.
Yeah, no, I agree. He was absolutely driven, but he was also he's still around. So I mean, he warm and cuddly. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't describe him that way, but I will. I would say he was always very approachable. You could ask any turf riders, anybody like that. Very, very approachable. If you had a question for him, you could walk right into his tack room. And, you may not get the warm and friendly, fuzzy, look, might get a grimace, but he was always, always very approachable. One of the things I learned from him, I was thinking about that myself. I always wanted to be very prepared when I was talking to Jonathan Sheppard, because I knew how astute he was. And I always made it a point professionally to be as prepared as I possibly could when I spoke with him. You'd be amazed how I would watch him even at the barn at Saratoga. I would watch when members of the press would come by, and whether it was a positive story or a negative story, he was always, always very approachable. And he was he is extremely articulate.
Yes.
He's a wonderful public speaker. He puts his words together beautifully and thoughtfully. He's a very, very thoughtful type of person when he's speaking, either to the press or just to anybody, really. But warm and fuzzy, no.
We'll talk. We'll hear from Graham Motion mid-morning as well. Graham, the most high-profile horseman to come out of the tutelage of Jonathan Sheppard, and there'll be more. And we'll hear from Jonathan. I kind of wanted to have some observations from others before we get a career retrospective from Jonathan, and as he is quoted in a couple of places, he's not going to completely like Keith Jones yesterday. Keith is available to do some cameos and some race calling maybe by appointment. So people in this, it's pretty tough to just walk away from this from this game. Nobody really completely walks away. While we've got Bill Gallo, Bill, it was such a torturous year for the Chase community, and the racetracks were able to get going and have some momentum. It was a much more difficult process for the Chase community. Talk about now that the dust is settled, talk a little bit about last year and what the the first half of this year looks to do to, kind of get going. It feels like you're going to have to tread water a little bit longer.
Yeah, but very well described. It's, last year was pretty bleak. We lost about 70% of our season, really. Thank God for Naira. Thank God for Martin Panza, because we did have 9 races up in Saratoga, which was critically important to us because, it gave us some sense of hope. But we lost pretty much our entire spring. We salvaged 2 of the meets. Middleburg races and the Virginia Gold Cup were running and actually in June, which was a major shift. And then we salvaged 6 of about half of the fall meets to a certain degree. We had to trim purses like everybody else. But anyway, long story short, we suffered dearly last year. But there is some hope, and there's a lot of hope, actually. There's a light at the end of the tunnel, but we've got to get through this spring, obviously, and hopefully by summer things will be normal or back to normal or as close to normal as possible. But right now we've got 16 race meets on the spring schedule. I just got a phone call this morning, 7 o'clock, our opening day, Aiken Spring, on March 20. They met last night and they cannot run. So they canceled this morning. Which pushes our start date to April 10. And so from April 10 on, we are going to see if we can put together a schedule. I think we can, not 16 race meets, but if we can get a dozen or 14 of those to go, that would be wonderful. The Carolina Cup was typically in the second week of the season, and they made an early decision about a month ago to move later on our calendar, and they're going to run Saturday, May 29. Which would close out, Saturday, May 22nd, which would be the second to last weekend of the spring. So that was a strategic move on their part. So Aiken is out, Camden is moved, and we're going to start our season over fences at Tryon in North Carolina on April 10. So that's what we're hopeful for. And then if we can get to the summer, and I know Colonial is planning on running. They have made a commitment to us for a couple of races each week, and I believe it's a 7-week stint. So we certainly would look forward to that, and hopefully Naira will have us back for our typical 9 race program at Saratoga. We normally run a couple of stakes races at Belmont in the fall. So if we can get back to normal that way, I feel really confident that we can turn it over in the fall, and with the pandemic hopefully behind us and the vaccine distributed and people feeling healthy and anxious to get outside again, we would hopefully run our full slate in the fall, which is, of course, highlighted by the Far Hill races in that third week in October, which is our championship day. But it's going to take a while, and in reality, when will we be back to normal? 2022, probably. But I think we're going to have a decent season. And I think the spirit of our horsemen is incredible. If you think of what they went through last year, and our race meet directors, those that did run and took a financial hit just by running, they did it for the horsemen to give them an opportunity to run. They gave them an opportunity to keep their help and employed and things like that. So it's been difficult, but it was particularly difficult for us because we're so dependent on attendance and sponsorship, and those are, without having people on the grounds, obviously you have no attendance and therefore your sponsorship opportunities dwindle. So very challenging, but we're we're not going to quit. You know, steeplechasing isn't going anywhere. The National Steeplechase Association isn't going. We've been around a long time. We're going to be around for a long time more. We've got very, very dedicated horsemen, owners, trainers, riders.
Well, and, you know, you mentioned Far Hills, and of course, I tried a couple of times to connect with Guy Torsiglieri, and all the work that had gone into planning for what was scheduled to be the 100th meeting at Far Hills. And, you know, it'll still be the 100th meeting, but it does feel like, you know, by the time we get to summer and certainly fall, the conditions will be such, hopefully, that, you know, that he gets to execute this. I mean, he put in so much effort, you know, with the idea of, you know, culminating in that 100th meeting. And I think I, you know, of all, not that every other, you know, meet and every other venue, you know, that had to either amend or cancel, postpone, et cetera, you know, feel bad for everybody, but it really, for Far Hills last year, it just really felt like a rug being pulled out from under.
Yeah, it was a dagger. They had an enormous plan, $1 million in purses for one day. That's our champ. It was meant to be our championship day, and Guy Torsiglieri wanted to make it meaningful, and that was that was a devastating blow. I will tell you that rocked me for sure. But they're, you know, Far Hills, once again, they've been around a long time, and they've done an incredible job of growing that event and making it a you know, annual event that just that the local community embraces. The sponsorship, the amount of money that they give to charity is just extraordinary. So they'll be back for sure.
Well, Bill Gallo with us from NSA, National Steeplechase Association, and we gathered to, you know, appreciate the career of Jonathan Shepherd. And one thing as we wrap up too, Bill, the suggestion that came off of Twitter, Mike Adams floating the idea of attaching Jonathan's name to you know, perhaps the Turf Riders or creating a new stake. How did that idea strike you?
I think it's very appropriate. I think it's a great idea. As long as Martin Panza is in favor, and as long as the New York Turf Riders, are there any more? I think Dave Grenning's one of the few left. But back in the day, when the race was named the New York Turf Riders, there were a significant number of New York Turf Riders. That number has dwindled. You know, perhaps a co-sharing, I think you had suggested, which is, you know, might be a good way to do it, the Jonathan Shepherd New York Turf Riders Cup. But we've got to attach Jonathan Shepherd's name to a very significant Grade One race for sure. And what better place than Saratoga? He was a leading trainer in, I can't remember what year it was now. You'd remember before I would. He was a leading trainer at the meet. Obviously won more flat races than jump races that year, but still. Saratoga is a special place for Shepherd. It's a place where a Grade One race should be named after him, and the Turf Riders would be a great candidate.
We'll hear more later with Graham Motion, who worked and has a direct tie and get some of the horsemanship tidbits that are always interesting. That one about adding Guinness Stout made me laugh. I'm going to forget which horse it was that was a non-sweater.
Yeah, non-sweater. Yeah, it was, I think, one of his fillies. I'm not sure. Graham will tell you.
I love it. So, Bill, I appreciate it, and happy, healthy to you and everybody at NSA, and obviously, you know, going to be a little bit more of a watch and wait, but whatever you need communicated out there, please let me know.
Thank you so much. God bless Jonathan Shepherd.
Bill Gallo, everybody, and appreciating the long, you wanted to talk long, 5.5 decades, a long career of Shepherd. Top of the hour, and we'll take a break here. Have Jay Pribman swing by, and we'll get a chance to kind of dig into the early portion of the Santa Anita season, particularly, of course, opening salvos, things like Malibu and more. And now, of course, we've got the first three-year-old prep in the books. Life is good. Winning the Sham. And you know, Jay, if you think back to, what was it, probably in the summer, when Jay first mentioned life is good, and to be aware that there was potentially another authentic lurking for the 2020 two-year-old scene and now the 2021 three-year-old scene. Take a pause here. Come back. Hour two at the races. Jay Bridman next.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at pabred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
From BRL Equine, the people that bring you EPO Equine, Unlock, and Bleeder Shield, now comes Flexify HA, the most advanced scientifically based joint supplement on the market. To find out more, contact me, Joseph Vellante, at 215-501-6880. To be the best, give them only the best. BRL Equine.
Sirius XM Sports presents... The Races with Steve.